Chapter 17. Collaboration is the key. Getting it together. This may sound like a truism, but I'll say it anyway. Collaboration, whether external or internal, is a vital component in building a healthy company, as well as an integral constituent of any entrepreneur's life. Many people have this almost ethereal vision of the entrepreneur as someone who operates alone, kind of like an artist in his garret, overcoming challenges and bringing ideas to market through sheer force of personality. Sorry, but this is the stuff of fiction. Going it alone is a wonderfully romantic notion, but few, if any, entrepreneurs ever brought an idea to life without a lot of help. It can come from family, friends, mentors, business partners, or all of the above, but to be successful in business, collaboration is the key. If you think about it, most of the important relationships in your life started out with a chance meeting with a friend of a friend, or, as my friend who invested in Google discovered, sometimes it's with a complete stranger. The digital age may have dramatically changed the social scene, but real life, as in face-to-face networking with real people, is still a business essential, especially for an entrepreneur whose instincts have to rely heavily on trust-based relationships. You can't look someone in the eye by text. This innate gregariousness among entrepreneurs is the primary reason why communes of like-minded geeks are taking the Silicon Valley concept on the road. I'd call them simply Silicon Valley clones, but creative hubs, aka venture hotspots or technology clusters, are springing up all over the world. Whether it's in Tel Aviv, Cambridge, Helsinki, Bangalore, or Hsinchu, Taipei, entrepreneurs and techies are clustering up a storm and reveling in the collaborative opportunities that result. Walking brand in brand. Another form of corporate collaboration that has been reimagined in recent years is the good old-fashioned joint venture, co-branding, the cross-pollination of sometimes seemingly highly disparate brands and individual products, is becoming relatively common, sometimes even between some of the staunchest of competitors. Among the ranks of the tech giants, for instance, Microsoft Windows runs on Apple computers, and Google Maps is featured on Apple, or at least it was until Apple kicked Google Maps off the iPhone. When Google refused to give Apple access to its voice-driven map navigation, Apple, prematurely it seems, launched its own system with some pretty disastrous results. The new Apple Map system was plagued with errors. There were thousands of much-publicized howlers, like Helsinki's main railway station vanishing and appearing instead as a park. Apple apologized, and when Google Maps was allowed back as an app, there were over 10 million downloads in 48 hours. A five-ring circus. One of the unexpected talking points to come out of the Sochi Winter Olympics was all about co-branding, even if it was for all the wrong reasons. The sleek aerodynamic suits that sports clothing manufacturer Under Armour and unlikely collaborator aerospace giant Lockheed Martin jointly developed for the US speed skating team were supposed to ensure a gold rush for the Americans. Instead, they turned into a PR disaster for all concerned, as the previously untested suits became the scapegoat for the American team's failure to win any of the early races in which they were highly favored. Before the end of the games, they had reverted to using their old low-tech suits, albeit with only marginally better results. Perhaps this just serves to demonstrate the importance of picking the right dance partner. After all, the F-35 Lightning jet fighter and speed skating suits have seldom appeared in the same sentence before. Other interesting and more successful brand marriages I've spotted are Apple and Nike, who developed a wireless system that allows sneakers to talk to the owner's iPod and record their activities. Audi and Leica, with a camera, not a car. JBL and Nokia on matching smartphone and portable speakers. And perhaps most tempting of all, the trio of HP, Google, and Gogo, the leading supplier of in-flight Wi-Fi systems to the world's airlines, who hooked up to produce the very cool Chromebook 11 laptop, which, among other things, features complimentary in-flight Wi-Fi on all Gogo-equipped airlines. This last one is a great example of the really smart upsides that can come from partnering with the right people. The free in-flight Gogo offer, which usually costs between $10 and $15 per trip, means that if you are a frequent flyer, you could recoup the entire price of the laptop, around $300, in as few as a dozen or so round-trip flights. Clever stuff. In commercial aviation circles, alliances, yet another word for collaborations, have become the big thing, and they seem to be working, for the airlines at least. The 60-plus member carriers in the big three alliances, Oneworld, SkyTeam, and the Star Alliance, which was the first of the breed, account for almost 1.5 billion passengers a year, which equates to a staggering 77% of all airline traffic. In each of the alliance groupings, all sorts of direct competitors have found there is more to be gained by teaming up with each other than fighting a lone battle to survive. In some cases, carriers such as American Airlines and British Airways, or Air France and Delta, have formed even tighter collaborations that stop short of merging their companies, but still accrue many of the same advantages. With Delta replacing Singapore Airlines with a 49% equity stake in Virgin Atlantic, we are looking forward to collaborating with them by feeding traffic into each other's route networks around the world. At the time of writing, we have not thrown any of our own airline caps into any alliances, but that could change if we can be convinced that there is sufficient upside. Clearly, with 60 other airlines doing it, there has to be something positive going on here, but we won't do anything that might negatively impact our ability to do things in our own peculiar way. Lowest common denominators are not a healthy measurement of any grouping. Silos are for grain. As significant and compelling as outside liaisons may be in expanding a business into new markets or extending the reach of a brand, there is another much more important and often overlooked area in which collaboration is often sadly lacking or even absent, and that's within your own company. There are lots of arguments for keeping the number of employees in a company below a certain critical mass. One of them is certainly minimizing the silo effect that seems to proliferate in bigger companies. This is the phenomenon where, rather than working as one on achieving a single corporate objective and maintaining a uniform, healthy corporate culture, a workforce separates into its own distinct silos. Senior management will often be off somewhere else in their own ivory silo, while sales, marketing, product development, finance, IT, and all the other components will be firmly entrenched in their own hard shell silos. The bridges connecting them will usually only be on the upper floors, so that the heads of each group can have access to each other, even if it is not used on a regular enough basis. The lower echelons seldom, if ever, cross over to the other side for fear of appearing disloyal to their own commune members. Within each silo, there is usually loyalty to their immediate group, but nothing except distrust and suspicion as to the motives and/or capabilities of every other division in the company. Sales will think marketing knows nothing about their real-world needs, while marketing thinks product development hasn't got a clue, which in the absence of sufficient feedback from sales and marketing may well be the case. Finance doesn't see the business as anything except a bunch of data that they usually get late and believes that everyone is out to cheat on their expenses. And IT, well, they're just doing their own thing as nobody speaks to them except when they have a problem. In a multinational company, the problems are usually only multiplied. The Brits will often treat the Americans with xenophobic disdain. The Yanks can't even spell aluminium, for goodness sake! And so on and so on. The lack of communication that results from such a stultifying situation makes for a series of self-fulfilling prophecies at every level. Product development is rushing to design a new triangular widget because they heard from someone that the competition was doing the same. Sales is outselling the new round one that has been promised by their boss, who failed to read the email from marketing that they'd recommended changing it to a square one. When the triangular widget is finally unveiled, everyone is unhappy, especially the customer service group, which had put in a request for an octagonal one, but never received a response. All overstated caricatures, perhaps, but not that far from the truth at many a dysfunctional, silo-ridden company. Real-life examples of this abound, particularly in the fast-moving technology world. I mentioned one earlier with Apple's rush to get their own flawed version of Google Maps to market. Another was Microsoft's Me Too attempt in 2006 to produce a competitive product to the iPod, which at the time enjoyed a 65% market share. The short-lived Zune would never make it out of single digits in market share, lacking the design flair of the iPod, and it wasn't compatible with Apple's iTunes, an oversight that became a major drawback. You can just imagine the Microsoft sales team looking at their new Zunes while wringing their hands and moaning, "And this is what they give us to unseat the iPod?" Symptoms of chronic silositis. The good news is that signs your company is suffering from the silo effect are pretty easy to spot, and two simple questions should give you the answer. In a normal week, do you spend at least 25% of your time speaking to colleagues from outside of your own division? Do you have frequently scheduled briefings with the heads of other divisions? If your answer is no to both of these questions, then the chances are pretty good that you are operating in silo mode, and you need to take steps to dismantle it before it dismantles the company. The good news is that some of the fixes are not that difficult to initiate. But first, where there is an effect, there is always a cause. So if things haven't always been like this, and in the good old days we all used to work so well together, then what, or more likely, who, has changed? If it has just been a general slide into this state of affairs, then it really has to be down to the CEO to step up, be accountable, and take responsibility for curing the malaise. If the root of the problem can be traced to when someone new came in or was promoted to lead one of the divisions, then perhaps some corrective surgery is called for. In the meantime, there are some simple first steps to be taken. The CEO should call a meeting of all the division heads and their deputies to tackle the internal communication problem and hammer home why it has to change. Don't mince words and use any pertinent examples of late delivery of projects or cancelled programs that might have been avoided with better collaboration between divisions. Clear the air and flush out any lingering feuds, finger-pointing, or negative rumors so that there can be a fresh start and consensus on the way forward. Set a weekly senior management meeting schedule, maximum 1 hour in length, that will be mandatory for all unless there is a very good reason to be elsewhere. At these meetings, the CEO should give a corporate update, followed by each division head's report on their divisions. Division heads should use this as an opportunity to invite input from other departments and seek their assistance if appropriate. Take a long, hard look at how effectively management communicates with the staff. Use technology and social media to ensure that all of your employees always hear about breaking company news from the company, and at all costs before they read about it in the business pages. I am an almost daily blogger, and I know a significant percentage of my followers are Virgin employees. I should perhaps make it clear that I am not a big fan of meetings for the sake of meetings-based cultures, as, somewhat paradoxically, I have found that a prime reason for poor corporate communications can often be that there are simply too many meetings. I have even seen some cultures in which management appears to spend 80% of its time in meetings discussing what they plan to do with the other 20% of their time. The catastrophic British Rail operation we inherited in 1997, for instance, was certainly one such organization. BR employees repeatedly told us how happy they were to see Virgin at the helm, as previously they could never get hold of anyone in management, as they were always in meetings. These 80-20 rules seldom seem to work out very well, do they? What I am suggesting, however, is that a weekly meeting, where there was none, can be a good start to unclogging the communication arteries. Maybe even the start of a new era, although getting the workforce thinking and acting as one and revitalizing the company culture at the same time will take a lot more than just a few meetings. So now we get to the more interesting and even fun parts. We did that together. The first additional prerequisite of the new silo-free environment is an across-the-board commitment to getting other divisions involved in new products from their genesis. That means from the very first discussions on the concept, not just when it's already half-baked and at a stage where any changes will be costly and difficult to make. One of the saddest phrases you can hear in any company is, "I wish they'd told us about this sooner," when there is absolutely no valid reason for the communication failure. At all of the Virgin companies, we always make a concerted effort to ensure that everyone who might be able to offer any valid input is involved from the very beginning of a new product development. From something as simple as a new menu for our upper-class passengers to the floor plan of a new Virgin Active Health and Fitness Club, we will seek the involvement and advice of the people who will be working at the sharp end, namely those staff members who will have to deliver the product on a daily basis. There is no point in developing a new menu if the cabin crew is going to tell us that it's not practicable because of onboard galley oven limitations, or that they have seen in the past it is not something the majority of passengers will want to eat. Or if an architect hasn't got experienced Virgin Active staff giving input on how the gym floor works, we risk opening the new club and having them ask, "Where are we supposed to store the towels?" or some similar, seemingly minor, but important oversight that could have been avoided with better upfront collaboration. Someone once put it very cleverly when they said, "There would be no problems with square pegs and round holes if the peg department and the hole department were the whole department." Tearing down the silo walls has a multitude of upsides. Not only do the different co-workers learn more about the needs and priorities of other divisions and create relationships there, but it also builds buy-in to innovative ideas and pride of ownership when the final product goes live. When a company embraces the benefits of collaboration, the old cynical silo dwellers' classic moan of, "I wish they'd asked for our opinion on this," will be replaced with, "We developed that together and we can all be proud of it." This is truly a win-win-win for the company, the staff, and lest we forget, for the customer as well. The fun part of a post-silo renaissance is learning how to have a good time together. As I discussed in an earlier chapter, I am still a firm believer in the power of the party. This is not a political statement. I am talking about a good old-fashioned let your hair down and have a good time with your colleagues, company celebration. And we don't have to wait for Christmas to do it. Getting the troops to have some fun together is the surest way to make sure the silo walls don't get rebuilt. If there are opportunities for company sports teams, then that's another great area to explore, and twist your controller's arm to spring some cash to supply the company logoed football shirts or softball jerseys. Paying it back pays off. Another great way to reunite your people is to encourage them to team up and get involved in community or other charitable events. We have seen countless examples of our people doing good together, whether it's running as a team, raising money for their favorite charities in the London or New York marathons, or black bagging it and clearing up the fields around a local children's playground. Doing good things for our communities is an integral part of working at any Virgin company, and we know that it's incredibly important to our staff. At Virgin Media UK, for example, each employee is given a day off every year to give back to their local communities. The tricky bit about these kind of things is figuring out the best way to assist your people in optimizing their precious time, and in ways that don't require a financial commitment, an important factor in these tough times. To this end, Media came up with 5 ingenious themes for 5 different days. 3 of them, give time, give stuff, give life, are all ways to use time and existing possessions to make a difference, while give a shout and give a pat on the back are ways to recognize what people are already doing and to encourage them to keep up the good work. Give time is about volunteering, and to plan the most productive use of their day off, we encouraged people to spend 10 minutes looking at what they could volunteer for and telling their manager about it. Give stuff is based on the old saying that one man's junk is another man's treasure, and we ask people to do a quick raid of their old clothes, linens, furniture, anything they no longer use, and bring it all in for central collection. Give Life encourages people to go and sign up for blood donations, the Organ Donor Register, and in the UK, the Anthony Nolan Stem Cell and Bone Marrow Register. Virgin Media also introduced a policy that gives anyone called up for stem cell or bone marrow donations 1 week's paid leave to recuperate. The internal, tongue-in-cheek, named Give a Shout program allows people to recognize the efforts of their peers with a message on their personal homepage, also entering them into a draw to win one of many £50 vouchers each month. Give a pat on the back also allows colleagues to recognize each other, even bosses, for their outstanding contributions to the program, and, as with everything else, serves to build the team spirit in a fun, rewarding, and, by way of the funds raised, pints of blood donated, etc., quantifiable way. The Virgin way. The expression, the sum of the parts is greater than the whole, encapsulates the critical difference in the upside that accrues from truly collaborating with each other versus simply working with one another. Teaming teams. To use the analogy of a marathon, running one as part of a team is a much more exhilarating and rewarding experience than slogging around on your own. The task at hand is essentially the same, but having teammates to urge you along and set the pace while enjoying every minute of it together makes for an altogether more uplifting experience, and almost certainly improves your time. When I ran the London Marathon in 2010, in a highly undistinguished tad over 5 hours, I had my kids to drag me along, which made all the difference in the world. In the workplace, exactly the same team dynamics apply, even if, like running 26.2 miles, the task at hand may still be a rigorous one. Working as a truly collaborative member of a group of like-minded colleagues means everyone, no matter what their job title, has to be prepared to check their ego at the door and be willing to freely share their knowledge and expertise. Above all else, every team member has to trust the people as well as the process, something that has to be carefully choreographed and conducted by a strong leader. As part of the process, assigning team members with clearly defined roles and objectives would seem to be a natural thing to do, although one interesting idiosyncrasy uncovered by Harvard Business Review research into the subject showed that teams actually work better when group members are clear on their own responsibilities but uncertain on how they can achieve the team's goals. They found that rather than too much spoon-feeding, a healthy degree of uncertainty forces participants to think more creatively about how to accomplish the group's objectives. On the optimum size of teams, the same research concluded that while groups by necessity frequently must run into much larger numbers, the level of effective collaboration starts to tail off quite markedly when the number of team members exceeds 20. Just as small is beautiful has always been the virgin way in terms of company scale, so too we tend to favor keeping the size of project teams to a minimum whenever possible. Mike Rutherford, who with my good friend Peter Gabriel was a founding member of Genesis, one of my all-time favorite bands, on the Virgin label, of course, very succinctly summed up the power of collaboration when he said, "Being in a band is always a compromise. But provided the balance is good, what you lose in compromise, you gain by collaboration." And it goes way beyond the old notion that a problem shared is a problem halved. I prefer to see it from the perspective that a challenge not shared will often equate to a missed opportunity. Everyone knows there's nothing quite like the early days of a startup when everyone is hyped up and energetically pitching in with their ideas and visions of the future. It falls to management at every level in the pyramid to foster an ongoing, openly collaborative culture that sustains and facilitates that same early stage kind of energy and freedom of expression. This means as few walls as possible, real and imaginary. It also calls for leaders that are out there getting their hands dirty every day. Steve Jobs put it perfectly when he said to his biographer, Walter Isaacson, "Creativity comes from spontaneous meetings, from random discussions. You run into someone, you ask what they're doing, you say wow, and soon you're cooking up all sorts of ideas." Meet me in the piazza. Collaboration should have been Steve Jobs's middle name, as he was forever going to amazing ends to foster it. And not just at Apple. When he created Pixar, home to Toy Story, Monsters, Inc., and many other animated classics, he went to great lengths to make unplanned collaboration part of the company's foundations, literally. At Jobs's behest, the company's Emeryville, California headquarters campus was designed around a large open space atrium, a kind of latter-day version of the great Roman piazzas, which were and still are the center of social activity in most Italian cities. For me, Venice's wonderful Piazza San Marco is without equal. According to his authorized biography, Jobs even wanted the only toilet facilities on campus to be around the atrium, but modern building codes squashed that idea. Steve explained the concept behind the Pixar Piazza, saying, "If a building doesn't encourage collaboration, you'll lose a lot of innovation and the magic that's sparked by serendipity. So we designed the building to make people get out of their offices and mingle in the central atrium with people they might not otherwise see. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that withholding toilet facilities should be used as leverage for driving collaboration, but there is no question that any combination of silos, walls, and hierarchies makes for serious, literal, and figurative obstacles to working together. Conversely, their absence greatly facilitates the ability of leaders to work arm in arm with their teams and vice versa. The next generation of senior leaders will come from the ranks of the so-called millennial generation, aka Generation Y, those born between 1980 and the early 2000s. As anyone who has parented a teenager in recent years will attest, this is a generation that likes to do things their own way. They are less inclined to take orders and more into problem solving through collaborative interaction, live and online, with their peer groups. So get with the movement. Don't try to fence them in and control them with the old broken divide and conquer model. Instead, we should all work to foster physically and emotionally unfettered corporate cultures and working environments that supports this natural proclivity for collaborative progress, aka entrepreneurialism. So, if, like Apple, Google, and others, you are one of the more enlightened leaders that have already gone into piazza mode, take a step back and enjoy the amazing energy that's being generated there. If, however, you are still living in a world of silos and little boxes, then let me paraphrase President Ronald Reagan's historic Brandenburg Gate speech in 1987 and say it's time to tear down these walls and think outside the silo. You'll never look back.